caller says, I agree with Jared explaining it honestly as it is. I have full confidence in the quality and safety of Irish meat and milk. I know how strict the quality assurance procedures are carried out in this country. Another, were they not Irish cars in them marts and lorries? Another, please stop generalising. There are many on the left that support dairy farming. And Jared's just his view, and you've had an opportunity to rebuke that. Is that a word? Rebuke? Hi, Greg. In relation to people being scammed, well, not being scammed at Garrity's, by the way, just have to be really careful with the language. It is just the way it operates, and most people, it doesn't impact them when they're fine with it. But this caller says that they should return to cash. It just shows you people don't have control of the money if we go digital. Greg, can you please ask the Garda how common is drink spiking within the county? Having horror stories that a Dublin group coming into the county and spiking drinks in local bars. People whose drink is spiked instantly get uncomfortably hot and go outside for fresh air, and the group waiting there are to take their bag wallets as they are disorientated. A caller says, we're talking to Young Fine Gael tomorrow on their anti-spiking bill. Funny when you lose your job in Meath, the government all over at the TV, and in Letterkenny, not a word from them. Give us more details as to what you're referring there. Okay.
Good morning to you all. And
here's
and
Ryan Tubridy.
Let me thank you for acceding to my request to come before you today. We felt it was really important to be here. I've always believed in the importance of public service. I was brought up that way, and I have great respect for the Oireachtas as an institution. I've come here, as you know, voluntarily, because I believe in the work that you as a committee are doing. I don't say that in any other way other than that I want to assist in every way I can. I appreciate that you'll have a lot of questions, so I'm going to try to keep my opening statement as short as possible. I begin by clearly and unambiguously at the very outset this morning state that I'm truly sorry for all of this and for any part which I have played. And be it consciously or unconsciously, and anything that has contributed to the debacle that we're dealing with today. I'd like to apologise to the committee that they've had to take this time to deal with this matter today, and to my colleagues in RTE and to my listeners. So, given the events of the last 3 weeks, there is a lot that I wish to say, and there's a lot that I need to say. So please bear with me. My aim today is to help correct and clarify some very serious matters, and I'll be relying on my agent, Noel Kelly, here to go through the figures and provide greater detail. I'd like everybody here today to understand that the figures and statements presented by RTE over the last few weeks in relation to my remuneration have created a fog of confusion. A fog of confusion over what I was paid, and when I was paid, and what I knew, and when I knew it. Full transparency and disclosure on RTE's part, I'm sorry to say, would simply have avoided so much of this. And I'm here to do one thing and one thing only, ladies and gentlemen and committee members, and that is to set the record straight and to call out some untruths. And it is my belief that there are seven material untruths that I'd like to address. And the first is as follows. This claim that I did not take a pay cut from RTE in 2020, this is not true. I took a 20% pay cut from RTE in my 2020 to 2025 contract. Simple as that. I took a 20% pay cut from RTE. I'm obliged to do and present 205 radio shows and 38, as it was then, live two-hour late-late shows under this contract. I am what's called an independent contractor. I get no pension or entitlements from RTE. That's the nature of it. Under the terms of my contract, I'm allowed to do additional work outside of RTE. That's also the nature of it. And I stress that there is nothing morally, ethically or legally wrong with me or any independent contractor doing additional work for another client outside of RTE. But to be clear, I took a pay cut from RTE of 20% in 2020 for each of the 5 years of my contract at a cost of €525,000 to me over the length of that contract. I'll move on to my second untruth. The suggestion that my decision to retire from the Late Late Show was prompted by this whole debacle. This is not remotely true. I wasn't aware of any of this fiasco when I decided to retire from the Late Late Show. I made my initial decision to leave the Late Late Show pretty much a year ago. It was very personal. It was made in the heart and in the soul. Around this time, I mentioned it to those closest to me, my family and my agent and a few others, and they were surprised. They were very surprised. Why would you leave such a show? And I explained to them, and eventually brought them round to my way of thinking, that among other things, I had left a lot of me on the floor in the studio after COVID and during COVID. I was burnt out, being honest with you, and I was exhausted. A lot of people in this country, as you know, were burnt out and exhausted after COVID, doing a lot more important jobs than I was doing, but I'm just telling you from where I'm coming from. So I turned it over in my mind over a few months, but by the time I got to January, there was no turning over in my mind. I knew it was time to go. I made the decision. And just to make it abundantly clear, there is zero connection between my departure and this very raw situation of recent weeks. I informed management on March 13th of this year. I first became aware of this Grant Thornton review in May, some 2 months later, and even then I had no inkling of the bombshell which was to come when RT released their statement on June 22nd. The third untruth is that I was covertly or secretly overpaid by RT. This is not true. I was not overpaid by RT at any point. I fully accept I am very, very well paid. I understand that. But I was fully paid in accordance with my contract, which my agent negotiated openly and honestly and in good faith. There are no overpayments. Now, there are RT's under-declarations, which we challenged them on back in 2020. And there are indeed RT's over-declarations, of which they actually paid me in 2020 and 2021. This has caused justifiable anger among my colleagues. I understand that. And we're going to deal with all of that in the next few hours, and indeed the next 6 hours or more. We'll stay for as long as it takes. The upshot of RT's inaccurate declarations is an impression that I have been less than honest. This is not the case. The fourth untruth is that I was aware that RT were trying to conceal payments to me. This is not true. I was not aware that RT were concealing payments to me. RT acknowledged this in their statement of June 22nd, 2023, when they stated that Grant Thornton had made no findings against me. The fifth untruth, there was a secret agreement with Renault that I tried to conceal. This is not true. But not only that, it beggars belief. Think about it. I had a separate commercial agreement with Renault, the basis of which was that I would make public appearances and perform road shows and things for them. And the work that I've done for Renault is all over social media. The suggestion that was a secret makes no sense. The sixth untruth, that RT's underwriting of Renault's payment obligations was a secret. This is not true. RT's underwriting of Renault's payment obligations was not a secret, as the documents we've prepared for you today show. And as my agent will explain in more detail, RTE committed in February 2020 to provide this guarantee in the early stages of contract negotiations around my 2020 to 25 contract. This is unequivocally confirmed in an email dated critical document, 20th of February 2020, from Breda O'Keefe to my agent. It was copied to other members of the executive board, the director general, the RTE solicitor's office, everyone in RTE who needed to know knew. You'll find this on page 10 of the booklet of documents you have in front of you. Far from being secret, it was well known. And finally, the seventh untruth, that I did not ask RT about their under declarations of my earnings. When they released the 2017, 18 and 19 earnings, as they did all in one day, January 20th, 2021, this is a question I did not ask at the time. This is a question I should have asked. I fully, fully accept that. But I will try and explain briefly and as clearly as humanly possible. At the end of the 2015 to 20 contract, my agent advised me that I was entitled to a phenomenally large figure payment of €120,000 that has been variously called a loyalty or an end of contract or an exit payment. I did not invoice for that payment. I did not pursue that payment and I did not receive any payment. The documents provided to you bear this out. In my simple view, I had foregone that payment for €120,000, not taken it. But because of how RTE reported that decision in their accounts, Cathaoirleach, the narrative of the last 3 weeks has been that not only did I take this payment, but that I somehow contrived to hide it. So let me reiterate, I actually waived my entitlement to this payment and I didn't receive 1 cent of it. I hid nothing. I had nothing to hide. As the evidence provided to you today shows, My agent had already pointed out to RT in 2020 that we thought the manner in which they were planning to account for my earnings in 2017, 18 and 19 was incorrect, and we had understood that they accepted our position, so that by the time they released the figures, I assumed that the chief financial officer, the financial professionals in RTE, and the external auditors who had audited the accounts in these years, 17, 18, 19, had accountancy reasons for accounting for it the way they did. So I'd like to add that my company earnings fully reflect what I earned in these and all subsequent years. I'm particularly upset and disappointed about the decision and framing of the RTE statement of June 22nd, which inextricably linked my name to this whole fiasco. My name was mentioned 15 times in that statement. 15 times. And I was not consulted once. I did not have the Grant Thornton report, which RTE had, and which RTE acknowledged made no findings of wrongdoing on my part. I asked RTE to clarify that this was the case. They did. 4 days. 4 days after much of the damage was done. Pretty much all of the damage was done. I signed a contract in good faith. I declared my earnings. I paid every cent of tax. My employer has acknowledged that. It has engaged in deceptive practices to pay me, practices that were hidden from me. The result, I'm nearly finished, forgive me for overgoing. The result of this is that I've become the face of a national scandal. I've been accused of being complicit, deceitful and dishonest. I think the statement of June the 22nd was very unhelpful in this regard. The full truth was concealed. I take full responsibility. I can't say it enough. I take full responsibility for not asking more questions back on January the 20th, 2021, when the figures for that 2017, 18 and 19 were released. I take responsibility for that. I understand. But as has become abundantly clear and obvious in the last 3 weeks, this highlights the existence of two RTEs. Two. There are those who are involved in attempting to conceal payments and who were in a position to call me or call my agent and ask for our help in establishing the full facts. Instead, they chose to hurriedly issue a deeply, deeply damaging statement on June 22nd, which failed to include the full facts. I have nothing but respect and admiration for that great number of decent, hardworking people in RTE, my colleagues, my friends. And I'm very sorry for those whose lives have been made difficult with an incessant dripping of new revelations. I'm thinking particularly of my radio show colleagues and friends, that they've had to be put through all of this for reasons not of their own making. They work hard. They all work hard in RTE. And I want to thank those colleagues who have supported me through these last few weeks. And in closing, I'd like to thank the many people from across the country who've taken time to stop me on the street, decent Irish citizens, taking my shoulder and my elbow in their hands and saying, you'll get through this. I have nearly a foot off the ground high of cards and letters from people who have written to Ryan Tuberty, Dublin. And I got them, fair play to the post people in on post. And I thank the Irish people for that. I am hopeful that they will see from my statement and my appearance here today that I am determined to inform them of the truth and to demonstrate that I have nothing to hide. And I'm also hopeful that I will soon get back on air to do the job I love.
All right, that's Ryan Tuberty there addressing the Public Accounts Committee. Very, very strong words coming from him in opposition but certainly calling out RTE in their handling of the situation, that he wasn't consulted when perhaps he could, his agent wasn't consulted when he perhaps he could, and that he wasn't complicit in any of this cover-up whatsoever. That is his position. His agent, Noel Kelly, will listen to about 2 minutes of this and then we'll break away. And get back to our regular programming. This is his agent, Noel Kelly.
A huge respect for it, and we haven't spoken to anybody else, and we just wanted to get the opportunity to put our side across. I'll try and be as brief as I possibly can, but if you'll allow me. So, Kerlach and deputies, thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today. I hope this meeting will help to clarify the confusion which has arisen over the past few weeks. At the outset, I want to say that we appreciate the seriousness of all of these issues. The controversy over the past few weeks has been damaging to RTE, but it's also been hugely damaging to Ryan Tuberty, to myself and to my own business. Earlier today, we circulated a pack which we believe are the key documents that will help understand this crisis. The document runs 39 pages and it includes relevant excerpts from Ryan's 2015 and 2020 contracts with RTE, extracts from the accounts of Ryan's company for the relevant years, various mails which track the back and forth of the negotiations for the 2020 RTE contract with Renault. We've made redactions where necessary, but we've been as transparent as possible to inform you with all the information at our disposal. I want to highlight a number of documents which will go to the heart of the issues. Let me start with Ryan's under-declaration of payments made to Ryan when there were published figures for 17, 18, 19 and in January 21. This issue has caused a lot of distress and it's entirely a mess of RTE's own making. Ryan's contract from 2015, pages 1-4 of the pack, clearly states the fees he received in each of the following 5 years, and they're set out in clause 8.1 of the contract. It was 495, 495, 545, 545, 545 for the 5 years. He received those fees exactly, nothing more and nothing less. This is confirmed by the extracts from Ryan's filed accounts, company Tuttle Productions, which we also include in the pack.
All right, we will break away there because really what effectively Noel Kelly is doing is he's providing the evidence as to what Ryan Tuberty has already said. So there were seven clear issues that Ryan Tuberty's taken with that whole process. But now what we have is his agent going through a 39-page document to support Mr. Tuberty in his claim. So we just wanted to bring you that. I think we'll keep you up to date, of course, on the news in context with the wider, more important stuff that's going on. But this is just really a key point in that whole story. All right, stay right where you are. Back with more after the break. I'm very pleased to welcome into studio, I think for the first time, though obviously John's been a guest on the show before, John McLaughlin, the Chief Executive of Donegal County Council. John, thanks so much for your time.
Good morning, Greg.
It's great to have you with us. Okay, right. So I suppose we'll get straight into it then. What is the council's role? What role does it play in the implementation of the enhanced scheme that was recently announced, even maybe by way of comparison if it's changed to its role in the original scheme?
Yeah, Greg, you know, thanks for the opportunity to come on as well. And it's a good place to start. Most people that are listening and connected here will understand the old scheme very, very well. And in that, we have two main roles. One is to administer on behalf of government the scheme as written by government. And we also made the technical assessment, which meant making a determination for people in terms of what was the appropriate or the right term was the minimal remedial option. And that translated to money and so on for individuals or for applicants. The big change now is that we're still responsible for the administration, the entire administration of it. However, the housing agency has entered and they will do all the technical assessment and the testing and they will determine, I suppose, the fix and the amount of money people will get. And that's a significant change in our role and it's intended to represent a streamlining of the process, a simplification and intended to be better for homeowners in that they won't have much money to spend up front. I suppose time will tell and there's a lot of public commentary and I think the council have concerns as well and well publicised. But I think we're at a point now, it's been rolled out. The council will be making every effort to make it work where it can and then seek changes on an ongoing basis and we're still engaged with government in that.
How are you in terms of resources available to you to take on this and especially as it most likely will expand because, and we'll talk about this in a moment, it's more affordable for people to sort of get their houses checked in the most simple terms. So in terms of the staff that you have available to you to do your end of it, are you well resourced or do you need more or what's the story?
Yeah, and I should have clarified, Greg, we have to finish off the 849 applications under the old scheme that have been approved. So we have to see those through entirely and then take on the new ones. And the new scheme opened yesterday. Yesterday with one application as an example, but 23 people registered. Mm-hmm. So we'd expect a big flow from those who can, it can work for. In terms of staffing on our old scheme, we had generally about 6 or 7 people at the administration end and 6 or 7 within temporary help and engineering. We have added now, by the end of July, we'll have 7 more people in the administration. And government said they'll support us in that. So a lot will depend on the flow of applications. As I said, our role is somewhat reduced, but nonetheless still important. We'll see over time the engineering role will step away from that, and that'll entirely be with the housing agency, we'll just do that to finish off those 850 applications.
And it's a length of a piece of string, of course, but how long will it take, do you think, for you to work through those 845 applications?
Yeah, we're anticipating it'll be a number of months. Mm. We're going to do it on a prioritised basis. What I said, we will prioritise those who are at construction who need the money immediately to either pay off or finish construction. We'll work from that top down. And then in parallel, we're going to process the new applications under the new scheme with a separate pipeline of work. But there will be several months. We'd urge people, and I think, and we're getting hundreds and hundreds of calls already, to read your questions answered document, so on. We will be in touch with each applicant, and the importance of how to transition those existing applications onto the new scheme, and we're looking to do that on that prioritised basis. We're looking, having a look, how can we deal with what people would often say they're vulnerable applicants, how to identify those, and maybe how to get the worst fixed first under the old scheme. That is a theme of the new scheme. We're talking to the department back and forth, and that we haven't quite figured out what's the best way to do that, but there's a real willingness to do that, and I'd expect that to evolve over the next month or so.
Yeah, and how quickly are people moving through it? You know, because, I mean, there's a lot of moving parts here, isn't there? I mean, there's the council's role, it's the access to maybe money of their own if they're required at this point, or access for people to do the work. You know, there's a lot of moving parts here, isn't there?
There is, and in terms of how the only one we know at the moment how people are quickly moving is the existing scheme. Mm. That's been very, very slow. At the moment, there's a total of 75 properties that are either fully fixed or underway, and a further 20 or so have got their stage 2 approvals, so we'd expect those to advance fairly quickly. Those are probably people who are in a position to advance that. The new scheme brings new things and new limits and so on, so hopefully when people get their heads around all that, that'll allow many more to come in. Mm. And I do accept there'll be people who it doesn't work for, and there'll be a category that'll have to keep on pushing to see what can be done to make it work for them.
Yeah. But, I mean, obviously all this building activities already on top of all building activities, I know this is not necessarily a concern for you, but you'd be across it. I mean, do we know how many houses realistically we can be repairing on an annual basis? Not a figure that I would hold you to, but just has that conversation come up between you and your team? As I say, it's much that's outside of your responsibility, but just as a curiosity.
No, and I suppose it is outside our responsibility in terms of the application process. But as a council, we're very interested in that, not just for the in terms of the remedial measure, but even our own construction of houses and other buildings. And there is a huge need for extra construction workers in Donegal, and the supply of materials, and it's very difficult to see how that will be speeded up.
Yeah, and much that's outside of everyone's control, but there's a traffic jam coming just in terms of housing, purely based on the fact that activity versus materials and those available to carry out those activities.
But I could see if people have a line of sight, maybe the bigger builders and so on, of a guaranteed workload and a definite supply, I suppose, of payments and materials and people. Others may move into this market in Donegal and the other affected counties, but we have it's a 2 to 3 billion euro scheme. It's a massive opportunity in that sense for builders and suppliers. And I suppose the early days will be important to get this off and running on a path where it gives that line of sight to those involved, and perhaps people return. And I know there's talk about extra apprenticeships, which is good for Donegal, but that all takes time.
We
need builders who are already established to move in and help with this. And I think the type of buildings may change as well. There's a lot of talk about modern methods of construction, and maybe homes built within factories and taken out. Mm-hmm. We may see some of that now emerge.
Rather than maybe hoping at some point that developers or contractors or however you might describe them sort of see the opportunities, do we need to be doing, be it through the Department of Housing or the council, proactively sort of almost marketing it and saying, you know, we need you here, these are the opportunities? But it's such a small market, you'd imagine if anyone's interested, they'd be aware of it.
Well, yeah, no, and we have had those conversations directly with the department, made some suggestions. The difficulty I had in the last number of weeks, and that's when this really came to the closure, the focus on getting the scheme rolled out and what could be done, not done in the time available, and indeed the legislation was passed. But I do believe there will be a need there to if the scheme works, and some people are saying it's not going to work for them, others are saying it will work. If it works successfully, I think that'll be the catalyst for those things to follow and the drive. And indeed, while we have many more houses than the other counties that are affected, we have to keep in mind we have a lot of houses to build ourselves. New houses on top of our stock. We have over 1,000 to fix from our existing stock. So the council have a massive workload on top of this as well. Mm. So it's going to be a very busy time for builders in the coming years.
Yeah, and I want to come to your own stock in a moment. I know you come in to talk about how the council's working the scheme, and some of the questions I'm asking is a bit of opinion, but we'll get back to. But in like say 23 houses yesterday, I think there's going to be thousands more as you know people come up with the 600 or 700 euro or whatever it might be to get testing. Like, do we have a target or an idea of what we can deliver on an annual basis in real terms? So in other words, if someone were in a reasonably conditioned house were to test today, like realistically, when might they even sort of see if they're approved and everything work on their property?
Yeah, no, and that's a good point, and that's one we'd been pushing for. It was an overall program manager for the entire, to control the entire process and look at those. That has not been acceded to. And we had our own, and I can't talk about it all on air here, but our own suggestion in that regard, that somebody would control both the flow, the cash flow, the supply chain, and all the rest. So you could have realistic timelines and single out those that are worse to get fixed first and set maybe a number of year timeline, and that would bring you that. But us as a council today, we can't give that answer.
Mm. And also, too, we have to be aware now there's other parties involved in this. There's only a certain amount under the council's control, and the council itself would be making suggestions and recommendations that you and your team might believe might make this work better, but you can't necessarily implement them yourselves. You can kick them up the chain and see what they think, but your hands can be tied in certain areas to some extent too.
Yeah, and I say we wear the wider hat of being a local authority, not just administrators of the scheme. So we have a huge interest, both our members and the staff, on seeing Donegal houses fixed. And that's where we're coming at more than just the administration of the scheme in terms of following rules that are given to us. So we will continue to press for those. And I think the next number of months will be critical in terms of how this rolls out and will people get on board and will it work for them. There's no doubt several people are waiting on this announcement. And when I say 23 registered, only one application came in, but we expect that to increase dramatically. And we would expect ourselves to be ready for that. Mm. Our role is simplified, and then it'll move to the housing agency, who, as we understand, have a number of consultants ready to go for.
So just in the interests of clarity, and I know you kind of outlined it at the beginning, but just to break it down into terms that I can understand, just so we know the role of the council going forward, okay? So we'll park what's happening currently and we'll just pretend we're starting from scratch now with this enhanced scheme. So just to be really clear, what will the council be involved in this process versus the housing authority?
Yeah. Step one for a housing applicant or an applicant to the scheme is to apply to us with a number of documents. Mm-hmm. Our role is simply to validate those documents, and then if it's complete, we pass that on to the housing agency. Then the housing agency do all the assessments and determine what is the appropriate solution and the grant. They then pass that back to us, which maybe people will be a bit surprised at this. It's sent that to us. We send it to the homeowner. And then the homeowner knows. They then get an architect or a building professional, architect, engineer or surveyor to prepare remedial plans to match that option. Mm. Or they can go even higher, but the grant is fixed. Then they resubmit that to the council. And in theory, that's where it ends and we pay the bills.
But at this point, and I'm not trying to pick holes in it because this is not the platform of the conversation for this. At this point, though, we don't really know if the science will tell us that you can't really do outer leaf, then it's going to be full demolition, or we don't know if, foundations will not be included. What impact do you think that will have in terms of the application and process, i.e. do I hold off? And maybe it's an unfair question to ask you. Do I hold off to find out, you know, should I waste my time on an option that's an outer leaf and no foundations when maybe early next year it will be a full demolition and the foundations might be included. And I'm not saying they will, but they might. Like, you know, do I wait or do I get into the process now? Because, you know, there's so much energy already going into this from people emotionally. They might not really know. Is that a question that you can answer?
No, but what I will answer in the context, I can't give a direct answer, but that depends on people's individual circumstances, how cracked is your house and so forth. But when I look at our own figures here for the 850 approvals that we have given out already. 527 of those have been full demolition.
Right.
So it's almost a 2-for-1 that are full demolition already on the old scheme. So if that's a snapshot, you could say, well, a lot are in that space for demolition in terms of the ratio. So all of those people would have been absolutely certain that the right thing to do was apply. There is that issue of foundations that's not answered yet. But what I suggest, and it's only a personal suggestion, if you're replacing the entire house, it makes a lot of sense to replace the foundation, even though people find it hard to find the money for that. But almost impossible to replace the foundation later on a new house that's built.
Yeah.
So it's, and I know, understand there's a lot of debate on that, and that'll come, but it's quite slow.
Yeah.
But I think the sensible thing would be, well, cut back on someone else that may be easier to replace if you can't afford it, and do the foundations until that's answered. And then, so it's I think it's really back to people's individual circumstances. There's nothing wrong, I think, with applying. If you're in a position to apply and you understand the facts, the housing age is committed to the fixing the worst first. So that would imply, more than likely imply, the worst it would be fixed, obviously, first. And quite possibly a lot of those would be demolitions.
So if I contact the council, is it your team that will get my house tested?
No.
Okay. And I'm sorry, I'm asking the same question for the third time.
No, you're okay, Greg.
So I'm just kind of trying to give people a realistic expectation that if they apply today, when they might get a visual inspection or a test on their property, we don't really know that at this point, do we?
No, we don't. And there's no point in me guessing that. That'll be a matter for the housing agency. And it'll take, in fairness, probably a number of cases run through the process to get that solidified. The steps are, you apply to us, all documents complete, and I would stress, very important in this new scheme to have all the documents complete. What we've been told is our job is to assess, are they complete or not? If they're not complete, as I understand it, we're supposed to refuse it.
And not that, send it back as such, refuse
you,
it.
You refuse it, and then there's an appeal process. So it's all built around supply the documents first time in, and then they move across to housing agency, providing it's validated. We're looking to see if there's a way of actually giving some scope for that for people who might be missing something. But it's designed to speed it all up.
Is it a complex set of documents that have to be furnished in the first instance, or is it a case of just making sure you cross everything before you do provide them to the council?
Well, it's if everything's in order, then you'd say it's straightforward.
Yes, okay.
But for example, let's say your house is on a site perhaps that's gifted by a parent or someone that's not in your own name. Those things then make it complicated. So for those people, it seems very complicated, but they might be able to demonstrate ownership. So it'll depend on the circumstances.
Is that ownership of the land?
Sorry? You have to be the owner.
So you could have the house and it could be mortgaged in your name, but the land could be part of a family farm or something?
Yeah, you have to be able to show you're the owner. So those things make it complicated in some cases.
Yeah.
And there's other things as well. So it's,
does that involve a change of ownership or a declaration on behalf of a number of parties? Or how is that square circle?
I actually don't know the exact there. I know it's been flagged as an issue a number of times, even in the old scheme.
Yes, okay.
But ideally, you'd have it registered in your name.
Is there any other potential pitfalls that people could look out for? Putting you on the spot here off the top of your head.
I think I'm not going to just guess those. Rather than mislead people, but I think it's if you go through the exact checklist and get help if you need
that
to.
That question is answered. Can you prove you own the land or something?
Okay, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think you emphasised that right at the very beginning. And I think really it's to make sure that people aren't refused and then having to enter an appeals process is to just go through the Q's and A's, check all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. Before you submit your application.
Yeah, and another point I might just mention, Greg, on the old scheme, there'll be a lot of talk about the FIA request for their information or sometimes incomplete information. Most of that surrounded the engineering assessments, and now that'll be actually gone over to the housing agency where they do the entire package, so that should remove that set of FIAs.
And we'll come back to that, the scheme, because we'd be contacted by, I would know people personally that are living in council-owned property. And maybe someone called out to the house a year ago. This is what was related to me personally recently. And they've heard nothing since. They don't know. They've got no heart in the house, no love for the house. They don't know what's going to happen. They don't know if they're going to get accommodation nearby or how all that works. Where are you at in terms of... is it 1,000 of your housing stock at this point that we know to be affected?
Yeah, yeah.
So what's the planning process
there? Yeah, there's different numbers mentioned between 1,000 and 1,500 based on visual inspections by our own team. Yep. And we would have gone around them and looked at them. At the moment, we have no authorization to fix those houses in the department. And we might as well say it here. We were told we wouldn't get that until the other scheme was running. And that's, a strategy. But we'd expect that to come to us shortly. We've applied a number of times and made suggestions as much as 2 years ago. We thought originally we'd become the, perhaps fix some houses and be able to set some examples in terms of how to do those. But we're, I suppose, in some sense held back. But we expect that to get freed up now soon. So it would mean for our tenants, and they're putting up with that. But there could be hope now coming down the road to them. We would have visually inspected them all. We've moved out some people where we determined we needed to do that. And we face this exact same situation.
It's a terrible situation for us all in the county, because you're looking at the same property that someone in a privately owned property might look at. You're maybe looking to get a contractor on site that maybe the private property might be. But there's not an awful lot can be done about that. This is just everything coming all at once to some extent.
Yeah, no, and that's why I would say it really needs the program manager to control all that. Yeah. And actually, so the council wouldn't be fixed. Just put an example, fixing, let's say, hundreds of houses that could be delayed for a few years as an example to allow others in. So that really ought to be looked at in terms of how that would be programmed.
Yeah. That would require a team too, not a single person, I'd imagine, because that's a complex piece of work.
Oh, yeah.
The program management team.
That would require an entire team with the proper, motivation as well.
Hello, hope's all well. Can you highlight this to John, please? Where would a homeowner get this piece of documentation? And it's a question here. It is a question for subsection D, details of quality control of construction products and materials used. Now, I'm not sure if you're fully across that whole document or whatever, but people will be struggling. Well, where would I get that information?
Yeah, I'm not sure in that detail. I think the best thing, they should contact the unit in the council that's dealing
exactly.
with it.
Yeah, of course. And as I say, I think we have to understand we can't. This is not a Q&A about the intricacies of it, but certainly call the team and get that checked before you subject it. Can the CEO shed any light on speculation that land bought by a DCC for $4 million for housing is to be allowed out for grazing animals? That's completely separate. I don't know. Do you know anything about that?
Oh, I've seen that in one of the local social medias yesterday.
No, I thought that was to be housing related. Sorry.
Two points. We didn't pay $4 million for it. Mm. That's the first error. It's significantly below that. And it's a temporary letting. We have to go through planning and so on.
I did not know that was about that. Okay, but so no harm to get an answer. Right, so in terms of then understanding, and I'm probably sounding really quite sympathetic, but I think you have to be to all parties here in that your staff are working through this as well. You know, they're discovering and learning how it works. So in the early stages, there's going to be teething problems, presumably, as people get across all the knowledge and what have you, John.
Well, there is, and we have already submitted some clarification questions, and we only opened yesterday about the transition arrangement and how to calculate certain things. It was important we start off on the right footing here. There'll be thousands of houses following. So the templates that we follow, for example, on the payment of grants and somebody complete, is the amount you spent or is the ceiling? If they and we believe we know the answer, we need that clarified, but that applies to everyone. The calculation of floor area, for example, what have you an upstairs attic? What have you used for storing your Christmas decorations? What qualifies as floor area? All those have to be, well-defined so people follow them and understand what to get.
Mm, okay. I'm surprised some of that stuff is putting you in a position to some extent. I'm not trying to pitch you against the other guys, but I mean, you would have hoped that kind of stuff would have been clarified at this point. But I suppose that's working through the first few applicants and stumbling across. It's like stumbling across these issues.
Yeah, and in fairness, there's been discussions on that, but the practical workings, when you work on specific examples, some things turn up that can affect hundreds of more people.
Yeah.
So it's a part of the first one done right.
Yeah, exactly. I call to say it's just their concern that if they replace the foundations, that you're classed then as a new build and you'd have to build current building regulations as it's a new build, and then maybe you couldn't apply for the SEA energy upgrade grant. So who answers questions like that, John? Do you know if someone wants to be just sure that they're not... can your team, do you think, be across things like that or...?
I think that one is a good enough question. I think an SEI is separate from us, even though we've been talking to them, and they've said they would interject their grant at the appropriate time So homeowner would know the max amount, the DCB grant, plus the SEIA before they start designing their house. They know that. In terms of, I pick up the nuance there in terms of the scheme. I think there it'll be the department will have to provide the clarification there.
Mm. Okay, another good question. So say someone has already had testing. This people are in stage two, okay? They owe the engineers $4,000. Now, if they were applying now, the engineer's fees would be much less. They still owe the engineers that money, don't they? I mean, that's a private arrangement, presumably, between the homeowner and whomever did their testing.
Yeah, although they'll recover those through the scheme. Anybody's at stage two, they're on the old scheme.
Right.
So they'll remain with us to the end, with the county council. So they get to talk to our team, see if what's the earliest they can get that refunded.
Mm-hmm.
But we're refunding fees all the time.
Yeah, okay. Anything else that I'm not touching on that you think's worthwhile mentioning, John? Because I don't want you to walk out here and I haven't asked a pertinent question because it's such an important issue.
No, look at what I'd say. It's, you know, this has been with us for many years. And I think the way it's evolved over the last number of years, it's been very difficult in the county council, I'd say, and for all our citizens. And sometimes it pits one against the other, which doesn't get the best outcome collectively, even though people are people and that's the way it works. And I think what I'd like to hope, this can be perhaps at some level a fresh beginning where we work together for the good of the county and collectively work on those things you talk about, the supply chain, the builders. What's the most sensible if you're in charge of everything? What would you do? And I think that's the space we'd like to get in. I think we've had a late involvement directly with the department, but it was quite positive in the last 4 weeks, and that held up the scheme getting signed.
Yeah.
We haven't given up on that, and they're willing to continue that. So, and they've set up some new processes for us. We'll continue to play our part in that. And we are strong across staff and elected members together. When we go now together, it's a slightly different type of voice when you have the elected members and staff and meeting the department. And to be honest, maybe they're not always used to that. And I think we'll get the better outcome. But we want the best for the county overall here and for the individual homeowners.
There's a lot of people working in the council offices that are going home to houses that are affected themselves as well.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I would say, this appeal to all applicants, and I fully get it in terms of individual homeowners and the frustration and the fear they have and the distress. But our staff too have the same, and we have lost people in this scheme, several people who actually can't deal with those calls, and they left in tears many times. And we just appeal that people are doing their job as well, and many of which have defective blocks themselves all over the place, including our elected members. We're in it together, and it's incumbent on us all to try and, I suppose, take a breath and get through it.
A quickie here, in terms of the initial assessment by an engineer, who pays for that in the first instance, and when is that recouped from the council or...?
Yeah, then it's much smaller. It's a building condition assessment.
Yeah.
It's really a visual type assessment to apply. I don't know when it's offhand, but the team will know when that gets recouped.
Specifics.
It probably gets recouped but it has to stand to verification when they're admitted to the scheme.
Okay. And talking of the team, how do you engage or contact the team involved in this?
Yeah, well, there's special emails, and I don't have it here at hand now. But
no problem. We'll grab those
and
get them
up on your site. Yeah. So they can call or the emails. And I would urge people, if they frequently ask question or your question, if that can answer some of them, it takes the burden off our people who are trying to process other people's applications.
Yeah. I mean, I think really what we're talking about here, there's a couple of classes of questions. There's questions that are covered in the Q&A, and then there are more intricate questions, and we got to a couple of those that will require further assistance or investigation.
Yeah, and what we will do, when we get some of those that might be considered standardised answers, we'll publish those so everyone can see them.
Yeah,
and
okay,
them.
Brilliant stuff. All right, John McLaughlin, Chief Executive of Donegal County Council, thanks for coming in. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Greg.
All right, the ongoing hearings at the Public Accounts Committee has been put to Ryan Tubridy at the moment by one of the members that... He stated really during COVID that we're all in it together, but when it came down to his payments, they weren't all in it together.
Before appearing today, either internal or external,
we did assemble a team of people to talk with and to get the best advice. I was always told that by relative minds, always surround yourself with people smarter than you. So yeah, of course, he spoke to people.
Yeah, were people in pay in order to offer crisis comms advice, either internal or external?
I presume they weren't doing it for free, of course.
Okay, I'm going to take that as a yes. I hope the answer to this is no, but were you advised by those people to delay the documentation until half
no,
eight this morning?
No, no, no. The documentation, and I am, my apologies for that. I think the...
It's a very comprehensive set of documentation.
Yeah.
It sheds a lot of light.
Do you want me to come back on
things? But it was to receive it at half eight.
Yeah.
And I think particularly of the staff who support this committee, who stayed up until very late last night.
My apologies.
Got up
to them,
very
yeah.
early this morning.
Do you want me to come back on that, or would
briefly,
you rather keep going? Okay, I'll try. The last 3 weeks have been chaotic. They have been destructive. They have been beyond difficult. And all I'll say to you is that we wanted to get things right today because so many people have been getting things wrong.
Okay, I fully accept. I don't want to interrupt,
hence,
but I have one
hence
night to,
the,
one
the,
night
we were clock. Working on this till the burning the midnight oil, so, yeah.
I just want to examine one thing that's in your opening statement this morning. You state clearly that you took a 20% pay cut. Is that inclusive or exclusive of the €75,000 that you are receiving either from Renault or... True or to you, true of Barter Kent. When you say you took a 20% pay cut, is that inclusive or exclusive of the 75?
No, I'll take that.
If I can answer that, thank you. The 20% was Ryan's contract was 495, 495, 545, 545, 545. That
so
was
this 20% refers to the payment direct from RTE.
I'll explain the percentage. So that was from 15 to 19, and in Ryan's then next contract. His salary was 440,000 per annum, which was 200,000 for radio, 240,000 for TV. That was 105,000 reduction per year by five, so that was 525,000. It didn't include the 120,000 that he didn't take, and the Renault 75,000 was a completely separate contract. So this was on his TV and radio earnings.
So it's exclusive of the Renault contract or the payment through RTE?
Yes, now, I
just have to contest that we regard this as separate. Now, the email over and back that we see in the contract...
Yes, and so it goes into sort of the areas of semantics there. But as I say, we'll keep you updated on how that progresses over the course of the day. Right, Guardian Highland Radio on Tuesday. There's a phone call scam. Scammers are using numbers like my own and able to phone other people, and my number shows up, and the people who receive my call returns the call saying, I'm returning your call. I've reported to my mobile provider. Thank you. And indeed, you see, that is very easy for the scammers to do now because they clone numbers. They can clone the local Garda number, they can clone the council number, they can clone your bank number, they can clone your mother's number. That's what they can do now. And I have said for the longest time on this programme and off it that we need more from the mobile phone providers, I think, to sort of flag and highlight in advance some of this stuff. Greg, you are correct in saying that automatic renewal applies in all cases where direct debit is involved. If no action is taken by the insured, the deduction just continues. This is not the case where you pay for your insurance in full at time of renewal. Your card payment details are not normally retained on file. I had paid in full. I would normally get a phone call or email reminder before renewal date, so I should have got the option to shop around before my money was taken. I'm concerned about the legality of this manner in doing business. Thank you so much for getting back in touch with us and providing a little bit more information. It's very, very useful. Thanks. A caller says, I was at a local filling station over the weekend. I'm owed €90 now. I'm on the state pension. I can't go shopping for a few days. It's an unreal system. So they got the €125 deducted from their card. They're still waiting for it to go, the balance to be put back in so that they can go and do their shopping. Greg, this is why we need to keep cash. Indeed, but in some of these service stations, you can't use cash. It's all card. This is turning out to be the Ryan Tuberty Show, a farce in front of cameras. Lies and more lies. Could try full stop giving RTE ratings. Nothing will be done. All right, okay. This could also have gone away for Tuberty, says this listener, by coming straight out and paying the €345 and future €75,000 instead. He came out with an initial dismissal statement back to staff in more need. Now he shall have to leave. Remember, some of the bubble had previously been... at the time of the bubble, on 900k a year with no competition, talking to the committee like it's his audience, galling, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, I think really today is going to be down to whether you like Mr. Tuberty or not. And I think people, I'm not sure views will be changed in that regard, but anyway. Okay, listen, thank you everyone for listening to the show today. We really appreciate it. Thanks for texting in and calling in and supporting us in what we do here. It's really, really appreciated. And thanks to those of you who watch the show as well and choose to engage with us that way. We're back with another program tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, but don't go anywhere. We've got a full day and night of entertainment for you. Next up, it's John Breslin around the Northwest after the news headlines at 12. But for me, Greg Hughes and Niamh and Caroline, have a lovely day.